This is Faith in Action, the program that looks at how people put their faith into action in their everyday lives. Faith in Action is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Now here's today's program.
This is Faith in Action on Catholic Radio. I'm Jim Ganley. Our co-host is Bridget Ayer.
Hello, Jim. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
You know, Bridget, I was just thinking about watermelon for some reason. Must be
where are you going with this, Jim?
Well,
I never know. Jim just is always rolling with all sorts of surprises over there.
I'm getting around to the fact that you can support Catholic Radio by eating watermelon if you buy the watermelon from Kroger and have registered your Kroger card with Catholic Radio Indy as your charity.
Now, okay.
That's all kind of backwards the way I said it. But if you go to our website, CatholicRadioIndy.org, click on the Kroger logo. Now, we don't want to tell you where to shop, of course. But if you shop at Kroger, you probably have a Kroger card. And if you use your Kroger card and register it, Catholic Radio gets a small percentage of everything you buy, including watermelon. That's where that came from.
Well, when you were talking about watermelon, I really more associate that with 4th of July. But the holiday that we have coming up, which is actually a segue into this interview, is Memorial Day.
Yep.
That's coming up. It's right around the corner. And for our history buffs out there, do we have a show for you? As we approach Memorial Day and honor our veterans, our guest, who is a longtime journalist, writer, researcher, Dan Leroy, he's going to share the role that Catholics played in the American Revolutionary War, which is actually a super cool idea, and I'm really excited to do this interview. In his new book, Liberty's Lions, we're going to talk about the role of some of these Catholic heroes that I didn't even know about. So joining us by phone is author, journalist, and teacher Dan Leroy. Welcome to Faith in Action, Dan.
Bridget and Jim, thank you so much for having me be on the show. It's my pleasure and privilege to join you and get to talk about Liberty's Lion.
Well, I read a little bit about your bio, and it was really interesting to see the different publications that you've written for. You've been mostly on the music beat as a journalist. Is that correct? Talk a little bit about that.
That's correct. Most of the journalism I've done has been music journalism related, a little bit of politics here and there. Sometimes the streams cross, but it's mostly music stuff. Most of the books prior to this have been music books. So this is a little bit of a departure, but a very pleasant one.
I bet. Well, how did you happen to pick this topic about the American Revolutionary War? That's just such a switch, unless you were looking at drums, maybe.
No, actually, it'd be a great story if that were true. It's a little more prosaic than that. I was lucky enough to grow up in a household where literature and history were valued and shared, and it was important to know both the big picture history and then the personal history, where you come from. My mom is the family genealogist, and so I was kind of steeped in history from an early age. The particular topic here, I'm happy to say, came while I was spending an evening in the Perpetual Adoration Chapel, which our parish is lucky enough to run. It's a 24-hour adoration chapel, and I was there one evening. I was looking at a column in Magnificat by a professor and a great writer named Anthony Esselin, and he has a column every month, the first thing I usually read, How the Church Changed the World. And this particular column was about the Catholic and Polish revolutionary Kazimierz Pulaski. And in the piece, which is a couple pages, but Professor Esselin mentioned, you know, there were some other Catholic revolutionaries, and he named a few folks who are in this book. So after I read that, I set out to try to find the book where I could read about all this stuff, and it didn't exist. And as an author, you're always looking for an angle, and there was the angle. And so I set out to try to write that book, and I wrote a book. I hope it's that book.
I'm just amazed, and I want to get into some of these, something that you touched on in the book. What the founders, Ben Franklin, John Adams, and George Washington, what did they think about Catholicism?
Well, those three names that you picked really are kind of different points on a continuum.
Okay.
The continuum, most of the people are at the far end of it, and the far end of it is fairly anti-Catholic. And there we would have to put folks like Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, Samuel Adams. John Adams tends toward that end of things. Benjamin Franklin is a little more circumspect. In fact, there's a quote that is mentioned in Liberty's Lions from John Adams, where he says, and I'm paraphrasing, that people thought that Ben Franklin, you know, Catholics thought he was a Catholic, Quakers thought he was a Quaker, and it was kind of this jealous quote about it, Franklin's ability to be all things to all people. But the guy who really stands out among the founders for his attitude about Catholics, and the reason that he gets a whole chapter in Liberty's Lines, is George Washington. He was unlike any of the others, both in his tolerance of Catholicism, but also the fact that he didn't just talk the talk, he walked the walk. And a good example of that is an event that kind of begins the book. It's in the first chapter. The event that happened throughout New England in the throughout the first part, right pre-Revolution in New England. It's called Pope's Night. And it sounds like a fun Catholic event, but it really wasn't. It was actually the opposite. It was an excuse to go out and get drunk and burn the Pope in effigy. Mm-hmm. And when Washington takes over as the commander-in-chief, the Continental Army in 1775, he says, we got to knock this off. There is no way we can expect Catholics to join this cause if we're out here insulting them publicly with this event every November 5th. And he stopped it. So when I say walk the walk instead of just talk the talk, that's an example. Catholic Americans remembered that example, and it's probably one reason why they have been so eager throughout history to claim him. I don't think the claim is entirely accurate, but the chapter in the book kind of gets at, you know, why people feel that way about him and why they have been so anxious to claim him as one of their own.
Well, I really want you to take us back in time here. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dan Leroy, and we're talking about the American Revolutionary War and Catholics that were heroes in that, and that's what his new book, Liberty's Lions, is about. Take us back to, I guess, 1775, 76, or, you know, the time frame that you're talking about. Catholics weren't liked.
Not really.
And I think it was, talk about that. Talk about the atmosphere as it relates to Catholics.
It was pretty rough. And a good example of this is, even if you were a guy like Charles Carroll of Carroll, who was, by some estimates, the richest guy in the colonies at this time. He wasn't the richest. He was definitely top five material. Even if you are a guy like this who has more money than just about everybody, you're still a second-class citizen all the way. And there are a lot of things, even in the most enlightened colonies, and those would probably be Maryland and Pennsylvania, both of which are colonies that are founded, at least in part, on the idea of religious liberty. Even in those colonies, if you're Catholic, you probably can't vote. You probably can't hold public office. If you want to get your kids a Catholic education, your only option is to send them overseas on a very dangerous sea crossing from which they may never return. And if you want to do this and put your 10 or 11-year-old kid on a boat thinking that you may never see him again just for the purpose of getting them the Catholic education that you want, you're also going to have to pay exorbitant taxes just for the privilege of doing this. And that's in Maryland and Pennsylvania, the enlightened colonies. In other places, you were publicly Catholic, maybe under penalty of much more severe consequences than just paying taxes or being shunned publicly. One of the things I think is remarkable is that in this period, the only place in the entire British Empire where you can attend a mass publicly is Philadelphia, in Old St. Joseph's and in Old St. Mary's churches. Those are the only places. Everybody else is underground, and they're served by circuit-riding priests who maybe come around once, twice a year, if you're really, really lucky, maybe not even that often. If you're lucky, maybe one of your neighbors has a chapel in their home, and the priest will visit that chapel. But it is, again, to repeat the term, it is to be Catholic, it's to be a second-class citizen in every sense of the word.
Now, Dan, what was it about the Catholic Church, specifically the people didn't like? I mean, why was there this animosity toward the church that I assume a lot of other people were Christian, but not Catholic?
That's true. true. And, of course, a lot of this is carried over from Great Britain, where at this time, if there's any place where it's even tougher to be a Catholic than in the colonies, it's in Great Britain during this era. So a lot of it is residual. But specifically, what is the complaint? The complaint is that people's loyalty is questioned. And the thinking is that if you are Catholic, you do not owe your allegiance to the king. You do not owe your allegiance to your country. You owe it to Rome and you owe it to the Pope, and therefore your motives are always suspect. And that is one reason you see some of the loyalty oaths that were administered both in Great Britain and here in the colonies. And one of the things you have to deny is transubstantiation. And it was a way of kind of weeding out the Catholics, a way of ensuring whose loyalty you're actually commanding. So that's a thing that comes up over and over again, the question of whose allegiance. And, you know, that's also an issue that predates the revolution, and it is an issue after the revolution. In fact, I think we could probably say that the question that comes up even today in terms of allegiances. So it's an old, old idea, but that is the locus of the complaint right there.
And I have to say this, I mean, I'm thinking as you're speaking that was even a problem when John Kennedy became president. That was a bad, even like, you know,
absolutely,
in the 60s. And so it hasn't really gone away there, you know, but so I think it's just really fascinating that you bring up that history as you're talking about this book. But many of the founding fathers were religious.
It's there are actually, I was going to say, like, you could write a great book about this, but actually several people have written great books about this idea of what exactly the founders believed. And a lot of them are children of the Enlightenment, and they are, as a consequence, they're deists, and their beliefs are kind of amorphous. There's a passage that's quoted in Liberty's Lions where Benjamin Franklin, we mentioned earlier, was kind of quizzed toward the end of his life about what his beliefs were. And I think his views are kind of representative. You know, as to Jesus' divinity, he said, I'm not really sure about that. He was pretty forthright not long before his death. But, of course, as was so often the case with Franklin, and I'm paraphrasing here, said, look, I'd investigate this further, but I figure, like, I'm going to find out pretty soon one way or the other whether this stuff is true. So he kind of left things there. But Washington in particular, and it's another reason why Washington gets a chapter in Liberty's Lions, because people have for a long time tried to paint him as one of these Enlightenment deists who didn't have any particular beliefs. That was a thing that some of his contemporaries believed. But I think the evidence is a little bit more compelling that Washington was, again, not like all of his contemporaries, and that Washington's religion was a little bit less abstract and a little bit more traditionally Christian. Was he a Catholic? Well, the chapter gets into that. As nice as it would be to see that, I can't really make that case. There are some pretty interesting details, I think, that come up that make you understand why people, again, want to claim him as a Catholic. But I hope, if nothing else, the chapter does kind of make the case that, hey, Washington was not this guy who essentially had no religion and never thought about it. There's a lot of evidence that goes in the other direction in his case.
We need to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to talk about some of the courageous Catholics in the American Revolutionary War. So stay tuned for more Faith in Action.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Faith in Action is our oldest, longest-running program here on Catholic Radio Indy. We're looking for some local Catholic businesses or organizations to help us underwrite the cost of this program. It doesn't cost a lot, and your underwriting support will help see that local programs like Faith in Action stay on the airwaves here in Central Indiana.
Most businesses have never thought about underwriting a program. They don't know how much it'll cost or what they might say in their underwriting announcements. Well, that's okay, because with just a phone call, we can tell you all about it. Call Val at 317-870-8400. 317-870-8400. The call is free and there's no obligation. We can really use your support. So please give Val a call right now while you're thinking about it. 317-870-8400 or email valerie@catholicradioindy.org.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to Faith in Action. I'm Bridget Ayer. Jim Ganley and I are in the studio, and we are talking by phone with Dan Leroy. He is a veteran writer, researcher, and author of his latest book, Liberty's Lions, and we're talking about the American Revolutionary War. But most,
and you could almost add another word to that title, Liberty's Catholic Lions.
Catholic Lions, right. Well, yeah, so talk about...
That's the second edition.
So talk about some of the Catholics that led the war, and given the context of how hated Catholics were and how they were second-class citizens, it was really a big deal for them to take kind of on leadership roles. So talk about some of the ones that you featured.
I will, and I'll mention one guy in particular because I think it's sort of emblematic of what I hope this book tries to do. Probably, other than the Marquis de Lafayette, Charles Carroll of Carrollton is probably the best-known name, I would say, in the book. And that's because people know that he was the only Catholic signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was the longest-lived of the signers. You know, people know some of the trivia about him. What they don't know is that this is a guy who 10 years before the Revolution saw very clearly what was going to happen, what had to happen, vis-a-vis the colonies declaring independence, and saw that it was actually possible for the colonies to win a conflict like this. And when you think about even after Lexington and Concord, people like Thomas Jefferson still trying to figure out, okay, how can we, look, guys, surely we can patch this up. Like, there's a way we can solve this. Charles Carroll was out in front of this 10 years ahead of everybody else. So when we say that Catholics were intellectual leaders of the Revolution, Charles Carroll of Carrollton is a great example of that kind of intellectual leadership. And then you have to look at his cousin, Father John Carroll, who was the first Catholic bishop in America and later the first Catholic archbishop. And through this friendship that he has with a guy that we talked about already, Benjamin Franklin, through this very unlikely friendship that they strike up, which really has to do with Father John Carroll just showing basic human kindness to this old man who is really racked with pain and disease on this mission that they take to Canada, because of his kindness. Benjamin Franklin never forgets that, and Benjamin Franklin plays a huge role in Father John Carroll's elevation to become the first Catholic bishop of the United States. And it's no small thing, because in America, bishops of any particular denomination, that was not a popular idea anywhere. So it took a lot of negotiation. It probably wouldn't have happened with anyone less a negotiator than Benjamin Franklin. But it all happened because of Father John Carroll and his kindness to Benjamin Franklin. And that is how, in large part, he ends up becoming our first Catholic bishop.
You know, a question that came to me as I was preparing for this that I didn't actually offer you. This is going to be a wild card question. What kind of population was there? How many Catholics were there in the colonies at this time? I was just trying to, I have no idea what.
It's a great question, and it actually points to one of the, I think, the important things about this book and why it took this long for a book like this to appear. At the time, the estimates are there were anywhere between 24,000 and 30,000 Catholics in the colonies. That is less than 2% of the total population. And not only that, but all of those 24 to 30,000 were not patriots. So we're talking a small, small group of people. And if you want to play the numbers game, you can see why people might have said in the past, well, you know, how important could they be? There were less than 2% of them. But that number doesn't reckon with two things. One, among that very small group of people are people who weren't just patriots, they were leaders. And we just mentioned this a few moments ago, but we have intellectual leaders, we have military leaders, we have, and this is very important, economic leaders, people who came up with the money to fund all of this, and of course, spiritual leaders. And then the other number that number doesn't account for is once you factor in all the foreign Catholics who, let's face it, that's why we're an independent country, because of the contributions of countries like France and Spain that were predominantly Catholic, and also countries like Poland and Germany that contributed Catholic revolutionaries. Once you figure those numbers in, then you're looking at what one historian estimated that as many as 70% of the troops that fought for independence might have been Catholic. Now, that's a little bit of a different picture than we're used to hearing about the revolution, but the numbers game goes both ways, in other words. So it's a great question and one that really speaks to this need to look at what we think we know about history and reevaluate it.
I'm curious, who's the book really written for, and what do you want people to take away from that, from the book?
That is a great question, and I suppose the author's dodge would be to say that, look, it's for anybody at this late juncture who actually reads books and is interested in history and wants to know a little bit more about the America that they live in. But more specifically than that, because I don't want to take the author's dodge. Just the idea of a dodge is a little bit repellent to me. So I would say more specifically, you know, history as a subject has been downgraded. You know, there's a reason that we don't have standardized tests in most places about history. That's because we know if we gave standardized tests on history, everybody flunks, including the teachers. So I want to stand up for history, but more to the point, I want to stand up for this part of history, which is the revolutionary era, that people think they know a lot about. It's something that does get covered in your average history class, but I don't think it gets covered completely. And I do want to challenge some assumptions about what we think we know about this era for people whose only exposure is, you know, a unit in American history class in high school and Hamilton. I'd like to go a little bit deeper than that. And part of going deeper is the Catholic contribution. And that also means looking at the whole country. And, you know, we tend to make our revolutionary studies focus on the Northeast because obvious reasons. It's Philadelphia, it's Boston, it's New York, it's Virginia, and that's pretty much where it starts and ends. But that ignores the whole western frontier. That ignores all the French influence along the Mississippi River. That ignores Spanish Louisiana. That ignores all the Catholics in this part of the country who also helped win the revolution. And nothing happens in the East without these victories in the West, which happen through Catholic involvement, Catholic financing. We don't get to Yorktown if it's not for what happens in the Catholic West of the colonies. So, long-winded answer, but I challenge assumptions. Let's boil it down to just that catchphrase.
Well, I don't think we can realize where we're at right now in our culture with the Catholic American experience, I guess, without looking at that and looking back at, you know, the heroes that there are, and there have always been heroes, but we just don't always hear about them. Even today, you think of all the things that the Catholic Church has contributed in the United States, the hospital system, the education system, the Catholic schools got them rolling, you know, and the universities and all these things that, you know, people don't realize now that really the Catholic Church had a huge influence on that. And so, you know, I just really love the emphasis of this book. Let's see here. How hard was it for you to find, to uncover these heroes? I mean,
well, I would love to sit here and tell you that it was super difficult and that it took me years and years and years to do this, and this is a result of a lifetime's worth of research. That would be untrue. And one of the things that I tell my students all the time, and something that I see in young people today, is we have all these resources out there that are incredible. The entire libraries are at your fingertips if you just know where to go to find the stuff. And I'll give myself credit for knowing where to go to find the stuff, but I think, I don't know, I wish more people knew where to go to find the stuff, because it is out there. And I did some visiting of places, and that's mentioned in Liberty's Lines, but by and large, a lot of the stuff had to be done through, you know, the old-fashioned way, finding the books, finding the online resources. I should give a plug here for the Jesuits. Their online library, it's unbelievable, the amount of stuff that they have collected. That was, among other things, one of the great, great resources available. And that also collects some of the writings of a guy who cited lots and lots of times in this book, Martin Griffin, who was a pioneering Catholic journalist who really did make his life's mission uncovering these stories and telling them. And his work was invaluable in trying to put a book like this together. So a hat tip to him, and certainly a life very well lived.
Now, Dan, give us the name of the book again and tell people where it's available, where they can get a copy.
Absolutely. The name of the book is Liberty's Lions, and it is available through Sophia Institute Press. You can buy it directly from the publisher at sophiainstitute.com. You can also get it from the usual online retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and a host of others. And if you would like a personally signed copy, visit my website, danleroy, that's LEROY.com, and I'll be happy to sign one any way you like and ship it out to you. And also visit my website for appearances, bookings. I'm trying to get out there and do some stuff, and I hope, COVID notwithstanding, to make the rounds this summer and fall and get out there and promote this book as much as I possibly can. So anyone who's interested, I love public speaking, and I'd love to come wherever you are, virtually or in person, to talk about this book.
Well, we are out of time. Our guest today has been Dan Leroy, author of Liberty's Lions. You can get the book at sophiainstitute.com. Thank you so much for being our guest today, Dan.
Bridget and Jim, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate the chance to be here and talk about the book.
You have been listening to Faith in Action, the program that looks at how people put their faith into action in their everyday lives. Faith in Action is a presentation of Catholic Radio Indy. You can hear this episode of Faith in Action again, or any past episode, at CatholicRadioIndy.org. If you have a suggestion for a guest or topic for a future program, please call us at 317-870-8400. Or email Jim at CatholicRadioIndy.org.